This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
For more information, visit www.outthere.org.nz.
Beautiful maiden, Hinamoa, handsome warrior, Te Tāne Kai, and they met, and their families weren't too happy about them getting together, and so Te Tāne Kai went and stayed with his friend Tiki out on the island in the middle of Lake Rotorua, Mokoia, and they removed all the waka from around the whole town so Hinamoa could not travel over to see him. So she sat on what has become known as Hinamoa's Rock, commemorating that event. She sat there and thought, what can I do? And in the middle of the night, she swam out to Mokoia, because Te Tāne Kai is often shown with a flute, and she followed the sound of that. And she swam in the night, freezing cold, out to that island. And so as the story goes, the official story, they got together. It was beautiful. It is the beautiful love song. The first Māori movie ever made was about Hinamoa. And the first movie, actually, which had a Māori actor in it, was about Hinamoa. So it's a very, very famous story. What they didn't say is that when Hinamoa got to the island, she pretended to be a man to attract Te Tāne Kai's interest. And when... because there was a pressure always to get together to have your children, so they did that, but they dabbled in other things. And when they were living together, Te Tāne Kai coined the phrase, I am dying for love, for missing my huataka tāpui, Tiki. And so his best friend eventually came to live with the both of them, because we know from Te Tāne Kai wrote a lot of poetry and love songs to Tiki, his male best friend. And this is where we find the word Te Tāne Kai. Takatāpui. Two of our Takatāpui scholars, Ngahui Te Awe Kotuku and Lee Smith, both found that. So that term has become increasingly used. We have information from the 1770s and all through the 1800s about people coming to this country and seeing same sex and both sex as common, absolutely accepted behaviour here. And so when we talk about our ancestors, even though they still were required to have children, once you did that, you could do whatever you liked. Now I look back on that and I think, then why was my father surprised when I came home and said I was lesbian? And I think, why when someone comes and says, I like boys and girls, I can't choose, where our ancestors are going, why just limit yourself to only those two? And I even think... And then I think about the grandparents looking at all their descendants and thinking, where did we go wrong? You cannot all be straight. And obviously there's a disconnect here, because what happened, of course, in the 1840s is the colonisation of our country began in earnest with the signing of the treaty. The treaty was an event and a legal, kind of legal document. But it's the process of colonisation. So they bring in the missionaries, they bring in the things that say certain practices they would always target. Sexual practices, always the first gotta go. And so it's a long road for our people then to come back to accept that takatāpui are still part of who we are, and it's actually natural, and the straight ones are actually the ones that are a bit non-traditional. And so this is all by way of being a long-winded introduction to Alison, our actual speaker for tonight. And now Alison, Laurie, when I talk about people who leave a legacy, and when it's so amazing to have these young people in the room, is to remember all the things that have happened before us, before we were born, before even I was born, and before that, for decades, a long, long time, people have been struggling for our rights on our behalf so that their children and generations after could live a better life. And so I want to introduce Alison as Kaitahu and Cornish. She, I believe, invented or created women's studies, lesbian studies, and now gender studies. She was the first person to do this in the whole of Australasia. She's a legend around the world in terms of... lesbian activists, a lot of people who've studied will have learnt from Alison, and she's going to pick up the story. So we had this huge influx of settlers coming into our country, our people are being bombarded, and we're fighting for our land, our culture and our survival. And I give it to you. front and...
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Yeah. You want to talk to us, Emma?
It's a great honour to come here and speak with you today. For me, you're the future, and so is that cat. Wonderful. Thank you, Puss. It's one of the familiars.
That's how to make an exit, people.
That's right. Of course, once, you know, rebellious women, especially rebellious women who liked cats and maybe if a cat, you know, spoke to you when you were speaking in that way, that would be a sign, you know, that you were a witch and you'd be headed with a one-way ticket, you know, to the stake. And yes, that did happen. Same-sex attracted people, trans, have always existed in every society forever. We know that. So why all the trouble? And there'd be a number of explanations for that. A lot of that, of course, is about power and control. Ways that different political authorities have wanted to assert power and control, and in many situations we've been useful targets for them to build their oppressive movements on a basis of ridding the world of us. Religions, which are another kind of organisation for power and control, and I don't mean spirituality because that's something else, but many organised religions of every kind have made it their business to exterminate us in one way or another. So those are some of those kinds of reasons. Not every society has had those kinds of unpleasantnesses, and there is no evidence at all that in Polynesia or in North America or South America before the advent of Europeans that there was any such problem, as Elizabeth has shown. But sooner or later, you know, the invaders come sailing in and they bring their laws and they bring their prejudices and they set it all up. If we go back a long way into almost a kind of prehistory, there some of our most wonderful lesbian gay historians, people like John Boswell, and in fact a whole generation of gay male historians died of AIDS. That's another terrible thing. But John Boswell died of AIDS. He wrote several very interesting books, among them Homosexuality, Christianity, and Social Tolerance. Very interesting book, and he says in there that there's evidence, and he was a great learned scholar, read many languages. He said in there you find evidence of same-sex unions, marriages, if you like, certainly with, you know, rituals of some kind, among the Egyptians. Certainly that's not unknown in Rome. In fact, Nero married a man at one point, the dreaded Nero that, you know, fiddled while Rome burnt. The Greeks had lots of same-sex relationships, both men and women. How people interpreted these relationships was probably different from the ways we might do that today, but there's certainly the evidence is there. And through all of those kinds of societies after the collapse of Rome, we find similar patterns. We don't really find any great problem with it until you start getting, according to Boswell, until you get to the late Middle Ages. And this is because the single event that changes everything, and nothing is ever the same again, is the Great Plague. The year of the Great Plague. The plague in the 14th century changes everything. In some countries, two-thirds of the population dies. People don't have a germ theory of disease. They don't know how it's transmitted. They think God is punishing them. They've become Christian by this point. in the monasteries of early modern Europe, Boswell found there were same-sex unions between the monks. There were prayers and songs praising these kinds of relationships. And one of the things, and interesting, I'm glad the cat has spoken because the cat reminded me. The cat reminded me that one of the things that happened was because they were so bewildered by the deaths, by the plague, they began persecuting. They looked for people who weren't practicing Christianity. They targeted women and men who they said were witches. And one of the things that might condemn you as a witch was because you would have a lot of cats. And they killed cats because they said they were the familiars of the devil. So they killed millions of cats. Now, of course, they got an explosion of rats. And, of course, bubonic plague is carried by the fleas that live on rats. So it, in fact, exacerbated the situation. So more people died. So what they began to do there in the late Middle Ages was, in searching their consciences about why God could be punishing them with this terrible disease, they thought it must be because of the presence of people who weren't practicing Christianity, for example, witches and Jews, and also people committing sexual sins. So that's where they start looking in the Bible and they say, look, you see, you're not supposed to have sex with the same sex and you're not supposed to masturbate. So God must be punishing people. So they developed this idea of a dreadful punishing God that just sits up there scrutinising you to catch you out, and once he's caught you out, you're going to be sent to punishment. So they develop a very nasty idea of a God, which actually suits some people quite well because it means that you can have a very controlling church and very controlling bishops and priests and things if you do that. So the church changed, really, in those centuries. It began to have legislation against buggery and also against women lying together, but the main sin for women was any kind of gender transgression. Women, in particular, acting or aping men, behaving like men. So it's not so much sex with women as it's some kind of transgression against the social role. And the most famous of the transvestite saints, of course, is Joan of Arc. And the reason she gets whizzed off to the stake is because she refuses to take off her male clothing. And furthermore, she says, St. Catherine and St. Michael have said that I have to wear this suit of armour and lead an army, and I'm not taking it off. No, I'm not putting on my maid's costume. So they said, well, sorry about that. So off she went to the stake. But there's others. There are more transvestite saints. And that kind of transvestism actually is associated with earlier pagan religions in Europe, vice versa kinds of arrangements. Festival days where everybody cross-dressed, all kinds of things in the early pagan religions of Europe. But Christianity really wanted to stamp this kind of thing out. So you have the ecclesiastical courts, which bring people up for them, and we have some evidence and records of some of that. The first law by the state taking over from the ecclesiastical courts is Henry VIII, 1533. And that's the crucial year for legislation against any kind of, well, against buggery, against sex between men. Women are ignored in that law. So you might say, why on earth would Henry VIII be so worried about, you know, guys screwing each other? Well, he wasn't. But it was an extremely useful law. Because if you're taking over the church and becoming its head, and you actually want excuses to raid monasteries and take their wealth, your armies, and because you have a belief that the monasteries are full of guys screwing each other, so you can rush in, put the soldiers in there, arrest a lot of them, take over their wealth and their libraries, close down the monasteries, and it works very well. So there appear to be political reasons for this kind of legislation. That law stays on the books in England, and there are similar laws in other parts of Europe, and hardly any countries have laws against women having sex together, and that's largely because most of the men in the church don't really believe it can be done. they sit debating about whether or not, how are you going to prove if anal intercourse is taking place between two men? Is it enough to prove penetration alone, or do you have to prove omission? And they had serious discussions about this for some centuries. So, but with women, they're not sure. So often the women that you read, the cases you read about, is they'll say some woman who's got an enlarged clitoris, which are probably intersex people, and so they'll get her and insist that she's been having sex with the devil and penetrating women with her large clitoris. And then there'll probably be another writer in the court evidence which says, and then I saw her kind of broomstick and fly over the middle. So some of these things are repensible. Yeah. So so that's sort of the state of the law. And the laws, it was the death penalty for buggery, but seldom applied because it was hard to prove. And in some of the accounts, for example, in some earlier times, you get an account of people, for example, a master whose apprentice complains that the master kept climbing into bed with him and screwing him. And the case is deferred, and he's sent back to live with the master for another 6 months until the court meets again. So that's rather odd. John Bray is the historian who's looked at some of those cases. Okay, so the laws reformed in the early part of the 19th century, so the death penalty is removed. And it's these laws, that's the state of the law when this comes through New Zealand. It's unclear whether the laws against homosexuality applied from 1840 or whether they only applied from 1858, which is the English Laws Act, which made it very clear that every law that was current in England in 1840 applied to New Zealand. So that indicates to me, at any rate, that there might have been some difficulties between 1840 and 1858 as to whether or not they could really do much about it. But certainly they did after 1858, and as the century progresses, we get criminal convictions, and then with the passage of the Crimes Act in England in the 1890s, which is the law under which Oscar Wilde is convicted, you get an amendment to that, it's known as the Labouchere Amendment, and it says that any sexual activity between men in public or in private will be punished by hard labour, etc. Oscar Wilde's convicted of that law, and that law is then enacted in New Zealand, and that law provided for very lengthy prison sentences, flogging, you know, very Christian. and hard labour, and that was the state of affairs for a lot of the 20th century. Some reforms which happened, removing flogging, removing hard labour, and so on. And so by the time we get to about 1961, which you get a big amendment of the Crimes Act, you get the first mention of women in New Zealand law, and that's to prohibit sex between women over 21 and girls under 16. And you might say, well, that's right, it protects young people, but the problem is once you put it into law, you can play around with those ages. And then you can just say, well, actually, we're going to criminalise the whole thing. So there is a danger that it's in the law at that point. Sentences at that point were 7 years for men. Mostly men got put in prisons, a prison in New Plymouth. And from that time, you know, we all knew men who were entrapped, and that really completely wrecked their lives. I knew one guy who was, he was entrapped in the 60s. He was a racing journalist and worked for Turf Digest, and when television began, he did those first racing programs, entrapped in a toilet at Wellington Railway Station, went to prison, and of course, after that, was never allowed on a race course again, because you're not if you're a convicted criminal. So it was the end of his career. So he, like many others, left New Zealand. So actually what we talk about a brain drain, we had a brain drain of many, many people for decades because people found it impossible to live here and they didn't feel that anything could really be changed. And people who, in the post-war period, you get the formation of early camp communities. And the word that we used here was camp, K-A-M-P. And it's a pun with camp, C-A-M-P, you know, camping. Camp probably stands for known as male prostitute from police notebooks, at least that's the only origin that people have been able to find, and came here from Australia. So influences into New Zealand come from Australia, as well as from Britain, as well as from the United States. Not much from the United States before World War II, with a whole lot of Americans here having Western recreation, and more research is being done now on the kind of influences they brought with them, which was pretty wild sex, both heterosexual and homosexual sex. And certainly some people say that they think that New Zealanders did not do a lot of oral sex before the Americans came and introduced that as a very prevalent practice. I don't know how true that is or how you prove it, but certainly an interesting thought. Anyway, there were sort of visible people in the cities right from the beginning, and there certainly were. The country was full of people who managed somehow to live in couples, managed somehow to slip under the dragnet and to live their lives. Easier for women, because everyone would say, "Oh, those two poor spinster women. You know, it's nice they're keeping each other company." Because women don't have sex, only men do. But the trouble about that, of course, is that, and in research that I've done, it was so difficult for women to earn an independent living. You can't live as a lesbian unless you're economically independent. So the liberation of lesbians is entirely tied to the economic position of women. And if women can't earn a living, you can forget it. You can have an affair with the wife next door while you're both hiding from your husband. But you can't set up a household together or have a relationship or build a life together unless you can earn the dollars or maybe the pounds and the cents, actually, at that time. For men, you're going to be suspected of being queers. So there's some evidence that what some men did in New Zealand, and particularly in rural areas, was they pretended to be brothers. They would shift to another area, get a farm together, pass themselves off as brothers. And then nobody would think anything of it. The other thing people did was lesbians and gay men married each other and had lavender marriages, which sometimes not so happy, because if that would often depend on, you know, I know instances where some gay men became actually quite, you know, forceful, and no wife of mine's going to get off with women. I'll do what I like, but you're not going to. You're the mother of my children. Can't have this unrestrained sex going on. The children might see. So there are differences between men and women because of the gender differences in our society and the different kinds of lives that men and women have had to lead. So from about the beginning of the 1960s, you get a phenomenon as the baby boom generation comes of age, and there are more young people than there have been before, and it's also a generation that has a strong sense of entitlement. You know, people grow up in the shadow of the Second World War and are told, that war was fought for you, you know? And things are quite good in New Zealand. There's free milk in the schools, you know, completely free education from the cradle to the grave, if you wanted it. Free health, you know, it's actually a much better deal than any of you had ever had or are likely to have. But this generation, and there's full employment, So this generation has a sense of entitlement, and it's also more influenced now from the United States because there's better communications. And there are radical changes happening there with the same generation, and also, of course, from Britain with some of the things that are happening there. And these are ideas about freedom, individual entitlement, liberty, and civil rights in the United States. And that's quite pertinent at the moment when we think of the President Obama and some of the, his harking back to the legacy of Martin Luther King and that whole civil rights movement. And it's from that civil rights movement that is born the notion of both people who became involved in that, especially a lot of white people did, and then they began to look at their own situation. Women began to say, well, it's really interesting, here I am enrolling black voters in the southern states of America, but actually I don't get equal pay myself, and as a matter of fact, the situation of women is really shitty. So women's liberation begins, and then a lot of lesbians and gay men and bisexual people began to say, well, yeah, in hell, there's laws against us and terrible things happening to us. So gay liberation happens. And these are movements which really start to promote change, which really overthrow the earlier ideas that people have held about same-sex and trans. And it's from this time, and that's dated really, gay liberation is said to have begun, in 1969 in the Stonewall Bar in New York when the police yet again raided the bar, and this time everybody fought back, including a big lot of drag queens and butch dykes fought back, and this was an explosion throughout the world. Now, gay liberation spread everywhere. Within 3 years it had come here. 1972, Mahuya Tawakoto, who begins gay liberation at Auckland University by calling a meeting, is called because she's been denied a visa to the United States because she's an acknowledged homosexual. And of course, homosexuals were among the prohibited categories of people going to the States. So a meeting's held and gay liberation forms. Within 6 months, there are branches throughout the country. So gay liberation says gay is proud, gay is innocent. And that's a really interesting statement, which may not be meaningful to your generation. But for people who'd been in prison, people who'd been treated like shit and perverts, people who'd been despised by their families, people who'd been fired from their jobs, people who had absolutely no protection about anything, and basically had internalised a lot of that. Like, it's okay for me to be treated like this because really I'm a worthless person. It's astonishing that suddenly there are people out on the street saying, we are innocent. We've done nothing. And gay is proud. And then the analyses and the theory goes further because gay liberation starts to say things which are radical even now, more radical than a lot of the statements made by any of our current organisations. Gay liberation and subsequently lesbian feminism says we want to bring out the lesbian and gay man in everybody's head. We don't think there are just special people who do this. We think everybody should be doing it. And actually what is really weird is heterosexuality. Why is everybody being forced into it? And why aren't people trying something else? What's wrong with all these people that have never tried it? And of course this is, as we move into the 70s, you get, and when people talk about the 60s, very often they mean the 70s. Because the 70s is when a lot of these things start to happen. Here, from 1973, we started the first lesbian organisation here, Sisters for Homophile Equality. Bizarre name, you might think. Well, you couldn't use, no newspaper would print the word lesbian because it was pornographic. I personally went to the press in Christchurch and tried to make them print it, and they wouldn't. But I thought they were going to ring the police. Because I was getting very agitated about them, refusing my advertisement. So that was an acronym, SHE, so that worked, and we started the first lesbian magazine called The Circle. Gay men had organised somewhat earlier with the Dorian Society in 1962, largely a social organisation, but with the legal subcommittee of the Dorian Society in 1963. That was here in Wellington. The first premises were in Manor Street, and it had several venues around Wellington. In fact, we've got a big project on at the moment, recording the stories of men who are involved with the Dorian Society and of women who are involved with Club 41, a lesbian club which emerged out of She and started in 1974, and that was called 41 because it was at 41 Vivian Street. So these are the first beginnings of organisations, and soon, toward the end of the 70s, we get the National Gay Rights Coalition, the NGRC, which... the NGRC was an umbrella organisation with over 30 affiliated kinds of lesbian gay organisations, the only one of which still exists is Marlborough. And the NGRC starts very clear objectives about changing the law, but also changing attitudes. And there is an uneasy relationship between the older members of the various communities and younger people. Younger people feel that it's more important to change attitudes than to simply change the law. Whereas many older people feel, oh, if only we can just get that law changed, we'll just duck under the bed and no one will ever... We won't bother people. We're not different from you. We just want the law changed. And we promise not to be in your face, you know. Whereas younger people felt it was very important to be in your face. Mm-hmm. Now, for many people, and I remember discussions where people would actually say to one another, you know, this is sort of pre-gay liberation or around that time, you know, what would your worst nightmare be? You know, people would say, oh, God, just imagine if you wake up in the morning and, you know, your name was in the newspaper saying that you were queer. You know, but within a very short space of time, we had people out on the streets openly with placards saying, hi, Mum. And really doing in-your-face stuff. And really committed to changing things and willing to make any kind of sacrifice. And there are people who have made fantastic sacrifices so that you could sit here today. And I could name them, but their names won't mean anything to you, and it should. Because you've been deprived of this history. So I'll give you one man's name, Jack Goodwin. Jack was an albino, so he was minority in many respects. Gay from when he was very young, went overseas and got himself together, came back in 1962, formed the legal subcommittee of the Dorian Society, and worked tirelessly from 1962 through to 1984 when he died, and he never saw homosexual law reform, but he fought for it. And when you look, when you go through the archives, which are in the National Library, the Lesbian Gay Archives of New Zealand, there's a big fat file of material from Jack Goodwin, who spent every day looking in the newspapers, writing letters to people, standing out there, taking all kinds of shit, you know, and just working his butt off. And so that's why, you know, it didn't just come from nowhere. Liberation doesn't just happen. People don't say, oh, goodness me, I never realised you wanted equal pay. Oh, let me give it to you. Oh, goodness, I didn't realise that women wanted to vote. Dear me, we'll just change the law straight away. Gosh, oh, homosexual law, oh, dear me, we must just do that. Doesn't happen like that. You fight for it, and you lose, and you fight again, and you go on, and you don't give it up. And part of the rationale for a lot of the people who fought, and another one whose name I'll give you is Barry Neils, extraordinary man, who also fought indefatigably, who had parties at his house long before the Dorian began. He was pleased when the Dorian began because then they didn't have to have them everyone at their house. He lived at the top of Hay Street. He was part of the Kiwis, the drag performers in World War II. His partner was Paul McGill. And Paul went to prison for 5 years during World War II as a conscientious objector. That takes courage. And in the Conchi camps, and they kept them in the camps until 1946, until every man came back from overseas, in the Conchi camps there were lots of gay men. So they're a wonderful example. They were pacifists. They stood up for what they believed. And somebody like Paul McGill, who came from that kind of background, fighting for homosexual law reform and gay rights, was just another step on that road for standing up for your beliefs and saying, I don't care what shit they throw at me, it's worth it. I'm not going to be there. I'm not going to be one of these people that, you know, sits about crawling up the bum of my employer, pleasing my parents, pleasing people. People pleasers are not to be trusted. You know, because they'll sell you out every time, because in some way they want to smooth the path for themselves. You know, so commitment to a cause requires many other things of us. Anyway, to cut a very, very long history shorter, homosexual law reform was finally achieved in 1986 after a most terrible campaign, a campaign where the opposition forces organised very strongly, were funded from overseas, from all kinds of organisations connected to the American religious right, which of course was very politically active. They were very well funded, and the country was completely divided. They took a petition from door to door, they took it to workplaces, they were there in the street with it, against homosexual law reform. Many lesbian gay people signed it themselves because people were frightened in their workplace. You're a pofter if you don't sign this. And then they went home and topped themselves because they'd done that, as you would. Well, many did. You know, so there's many things these people have on their consciences. I hate the Salvation Army. I've never given them a penny since that day. They took the petition around against us. They might apologise, but they've never actually made that good. And they've never really understood what they did to us. The harm they caused and the pain they caused to decent people. Our tupuna.
And they're still out of people.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Don't give them any money. If you want to give to a charity, if you've got things you want to give, you know, to a shop, give things to the hospice shop, buy things from the hospice shop. They're good people. The Salvation Army are not. The second part of the bill was lost, but that came again in 1991, and we got that passage through in 1993, and that was the addition of sexual orientation to the Human Rights Act, which means prevention of discrimination in employment, housing, and goods and services. Doesn't mean people can't be bloody minded and nasty, and we haven't got any legislation against hate crimes, but at least that law will protect you, and you can take cases against it if you're prepared to be out. Of course, you can't take cases if you, you know, aren't prepared to be out. That's a bit of a flaw in it, but at least that has laid the groundwork for subsequent legislation which has occurred, you know, in this century, such as the civil union legislation in 2004, such as the right now to have the partner's name on birth certificates for children, and reforms around adoption and these kinds of things. Not everything has been done. So I'll say that all of this begins really not even so much in the political organising, but in the courage of the men and women and the others who formed the basis of those first camp communities around Wellington, Auckland, Christchurch, people who hung out in the British in Littleton, people who were prepared to be visible and out there, who got persecuted by the police, but who had a sense of community and kept it going through those dark times. And from that basis, the political organisations could emerge as a new generation came with better education and a better sense of entitlement, so that we are where we are today. But everything that you've got isn't set in concrete. But if you go like that, So the price of this is eternal vigilance. And it's being prepared to say, other people fought to give me these freedoms. I will fight to keep them. And I will fight to hand them on. Now, the motto I went to Wellington is, the motto was, take the light and hand it on. I think that's a very good motto. Take the light and hand it on. Don't bloody extinguish it. Don't say, oh, well, you know, I've got it, so everything's fine. You have to preserve that flame, and you have to make sure you can hand it off. And you must say the same thing that I and others said when we would sit around, and that was that a baby that's been born right now, and as we are here, some babies are being born. You know, they're just shouting out right now. And some of them are going to be queer. And the way they live their lives, what's there for them in 20 years' time when they come to adulthood, is up to you. What you do now, will make that world for them. And make sure it's a bloody good world.
This audio was brought to you by Out There. For more information, visit www.outthere.org.nz.